Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Davis, and welcome to Expanding Mind. We had a little trouble there with the soundtrack, which is probably appropriate because our guest today, Mark Pilkington, created that soundtrack and has been promising me a replacement for some time, so that may be an indication from the gremlins who exist in the information webs that it is indeed time for Mr. Pilkington to replace the already pretty good but could be improved soundtrack theme entering for Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Oftentimes people say, hey, have you seen a UFO? You know, it's a big question. Have you seen a UFO? I mean, it doesn't mean you believe they're aliens. It just means, have you seen some unidentified flying object? And I used to say, no, I hadn't really seen it. And then I realized that I had this peculiar memory that kind of exists between a real memory that I can, you know, definitely say happened in my physical body and some kind of strange dream-like quality. It was at the Harmonic Convergence in 1987, I believe, which is already kind of a bad sign that I was under other sorts of forces and hopes and expectations, where I was hanging around a New Age retreat center on the Harmonic Convergence just to see what was going down. And then later on, I had this peculiar sense that I had seen something, and then in my memory now, when I look back, I recall seeing this very peculiar light and this strange ship moving slowly through the sky. And what's most remarkable about it is it's not a very interesting UFO encounter story at all, but it's rather the feeling that the memory has in my head, which is somewhere between dream, a story somebody told you, and a childhood memory, and something like a real memory. It occupies the strange place of ambiguity. And in my experience reading and being fascinated by the UFO phenomenon, that it's that sense of ambiguity, of liminality, of being betwixt and between, that is really the hallmark of the whole UFO world. Although, of course, there are many people who believe that they are extraterrestrial crafts. There are other people who very strongly believe that they are advanced weaponry created by the U.S. government. Other people believe they're the upsurge of the collective unconscious, the same part of the structure of the cosmos that gave us elves and fairies and ghosts and ghouls. So, of course, there's many ways to try to frame this particular enigma, and I'm happy that we have help in this frame job, this frame-up job today from Mark Pilkington, who just came out with a wonderful book called Mirage Men, and the UK subtitle is A Journey in Disinformation, Paranoia, and UFOs, although I think it has a separate subtitle in America. And Mark's a fellow I've known for quite a while. He interviewed me for 40 and times many years ago, and he managed to ask me a question about whether I had had a particular kind of peculiar paranormal experience, which I indeed had had, and that nobody else had ever tuned into. So he has a remarkable skill of being able to dive down and find those strange liminal areas between odd experience and our actual world, and has brought his incredible skills to this great tale about looking at UFOs from a somewhat different angle than they usually are, which is seeing the way that they relate to the intelligence services, the armed services, the development of high technology, and in fact, the explicit disinformation campaigns that strange little pockets of the U.S. government have unleashed upon the poor UFO subculture. Before we get to Mark, I just want to introduce our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. How you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks. How are you?
Good, good. It's nice to be back. I haven't done the show in a couple of weeks. I've been moving, so it's a bit discombobulating, but it's very fun to be back. I'm curious. I'm going to ask the inevitable question. Have you seen a UFO?
I totally have. There's been a few times where I did, but one of the most memorable, I grew up on this tiny little island up in the Pacific Northwest called Vashon Island, and I was there one night in a car with my friend, and we were parked on the side of the road, and we were surrounded by the woods. And then there was kind of like an opening to our left side where the ocean was. And we were sitting in the car talking, and to the left-hand side where the horizon was, it was the middle of the night, and there was no moon, so it was totally dark. And the entire sky lit up like a bright green all of a sudden. At first, we thought maybe there was like a car coming towards us or something. We could not figure out where the light was coming from. And we looked, and the green light kind of like rose over the horizon and went right over our heads. So it was pretty freaky.
Yeah, that sounds that counts as freaky. So maybe we can unpack some of that during this hour. Although we'll probably wind up with another enigma in our hands. But speaking of enigmas, Mr. Mark Pilkington from the UK. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Maja. It's very wet and rainy here. It's been raining for 3 days solid. Just to let you know.
But you think it's great to be. You think they're controlling the weather?
Yep, just like they controlled my soundtrack. Gremlins.
Yeah, really, your
even
soundtrack.
The Gremlins are critics now.
Yeah, everyone. Even yes, because among his many skills, Mark, in addition to being a writer, is an editor and also a sound man with a bank of very strange analog machines, which he plays with increasing aesthetic power and bizarreness. So let that be a lesson to you, young man. So listen, I'm going to start out with the same question. Have you seen a UFO?
Yes, certainly. It was, and it's actually the story I begin the book with. And it was in Yosemite National Park at the western sort of edge of the park out towards Mono Lake in 1995. And I was with my then girlfriend and another friend of ours, and we were on a road trip around the States in a battered 1973 Sky Blue Ford Galaxy 500, and we'd blown a tire, and I'd gone to replace this tire, and on the way back, sort of hitching a ride on the back of a convertible sports car, I saw in the woods, as we passed the woods, what looked like a sort of large, reflective silver Christmas tree bauble kind of just hovering off the ground in a clearing in the woods, and I saw it from a few different perspectives. And I thought I must be hallucinating and kept it to myself. But then about half an hour later, I was fixing the wheel on the car when my two friends both started yelling and saying, Mark, come and see this. So climbed out, and sure enough, just sort of bobbing as if on its own separate kind of current, coming out over the lake we were parked next to, right over the car, and then up the side of the hill on the other side of the road was an identical version of the same thing. It looked like an American friend said it sounds like a giant pinball. It was probably, I'd say, about 8 feet across, perfectly spherical, extremely reflective, and sort of bobbing in this kind of nonchalant manner silently over our heads. And then the strange thing was, you might think it was a balloon, but when it reached the hill, which had a kind of gentle gradient, it was more of a rocky kind of incline, I'd say, rather than to bump into it, as you'd imagine, it kind of reached the side of the hill, then just followed the exact same gradient at the same distance all the way up and just sort of rolled over the hill and disappeared. And now, if that wasn't strange enough, about 5 minutes later, another one following the exact same path did exactly the same thing, and we all saw them at the same time.
So what was your experience of that? Was it fear, awe, amusement?
It was amusement, really, I'd say, because they weren't threatening, and they were sort of puzzling more than anything. And I did run to the car to try and grab a camera, and this was so pre-digital days, of course, and fumbled around, but was more interested in watching the thing than trying to photograph it, because it would come out like all UFO photos, as sort of a indistinct blob against a large sky. But the real puzzle for me was, and I think that sort of captures what you're talking about earlier, was the liminality of the phenomenon perfectly. I was reading one of the more bizarre UFO books in an already bizarre field, a book called Into the Fringe by a woman called Carla Turner, who sadly died of a brain tumor not long after our trip, about a year later. But in the book, she recounts hers and her family's repeated experiences of similar objects, sort of silvery spheres that sort of seem to appear in her garden around her house. And in the book, the extraterrestrials that communicate with her tell her that these are recycling devices for human souls, and that all human souls are processed through these sort of spherical harvesters and then reintroduced into human bodies at birth. So that was the book I was reading at the time of the sighting, so that obviously was at least as disconcerting as the sighting itself.
I suspect
that... I've never had a satisfactory kind of explanation for what we saw. But I did discover that while I was researching this book, that the direction the objects, or if they were objects, were flying from was coming from China Lake Naval Research Station, which is where the Navy test all their toys out in the desert. So they could have been strays from there, who knows. But
at the time, I mean, one of the things that you talk about in your book is that you explain from a number of, you know, fascinating angles about the various ways that the, you know, governmental agencies and military groups in various different ways have influenced, and sometimes clearly intentionally, and other times as a side effect from their own developments of weapons, the whole idea, the whole modern lore of the UFO. But when you sort of saw that, had your experience, you were already very familiar with the UFO scene and had been involved in it to some degree. Did you consider that this must be some strange technology that's developed by the military, or did it seem too anomalous for that? Did it seem like it was a kind of crack in our world and some other world had peered through?
Yeah, there was certainly there was a very kind of dreamlike quality to the experience, because just, you know, you expect military technology to be, for one thing, these were just, you know, they were moving very casually and very kind of just sort of lazily almost over our heads, and so there was no urgency to them. You always imagine military aircraft to be going somewhere in a hurry. And these were certainly very casual. And, I mean, for another, you know, more importantly, I had... still have absolutely no idea how these things were powered or were, you know, supporting themselves in the air about 50 feet over our heads. And it did seem they were kind of bobbing on some kind of, some kind of current, perhaps. I don't think that whether it was they were using the wind or just, I really don't know. Later on, while I was researching this book, I kept asking everyone I met about the incident and sort of asked for different opinions, and the only person who gave me an opinion was in a position that perhaps to have known, and he hinted that they may well have been some kind of reconnaissance platforms used by the military, but he didn't go any further than that. But there's actually a long history of sort of spherical UFO sightings going back to World War II, so it's, you know, the whole UFO story can and it's all its enigmatic tendrils can be kind of folded into this one incident, I think. They could easily have been some kind of plasma bubbles. That's something else that's been suggested. So balls of ionized gas that could have been sort of floating their way past. And apparently when seen in daylight, these will look silvery and reflective. But my sense at the time was very much that these were solid objects, and that if I hadn't had the presence of mind or the nerve to pick up a pebble and throw it at one of them, you'd have heard a solid clang come from it. But, you know, perhaps it would have also fired its defensive lasers at me, and I'd have regretted it. I don't know.
Well, as I said, there's a lot of threads to your story. It's full of wonderful tellings and also retellings of stories that I was familiar with from other readings of the UFO lore, since you kind of cover the major events in modern ufology, and yet your framework is so different, or at least for me, that I really saw them in a new light. And of course, one of those threads is that the military has been developing, secret technology, secret airplanes and other flying objects, and that of course sometimes people see them, and that the UFO lore becomes then a way, not only a way for people to explain what they've seen, but also as a way for the military to kind of create a sort of shield against it. But that's really just the beginning of, to me, what's the most fascinating part of your story, which is the degree to which you show, and I think you prove pretty convincingly, that were aspects of the Air Force in particular, that were departments in the Air Force in particular, that were aggressively screwing around with ufology and really constructing elaborate hoaxes and drawing individuals into really quite drastic world views. I mean, it's almost like a kind of performance art, a governmental hoax or something.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about some of the most, the kind of core story that really shows the degree to which the government was kind of actively playing with the somewhat, willing minds of people inside ufology who have such a strong thirst to believe.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've really tried to do is go back through the history of the UFO story, which, is by now very familiar to people. You've even had half an eye on the subject, but trying to kind of reframe it within the context of what was going on, particularly with the Cold War and the technological development. And actually, once you start kind of looking at what was going on, and the sort of fears that people in power had at that time, it's very easy. Things start to make a lot more sense. So you have, even going back to the very first UFO investigation, which was by Kenneth Arnold, who also saw the first things that became known as flying saucers in 1947. He was sent up to Tacoma, Washington State, to investigate an alleged UFO incident there, where slag from what was described as a flying donut had allegedly dropped down into the Puget Sound, and this stuff had been collected and sent to Ray Palmer, who edited Amazing Stories at the time, and Palmer sent Arnold up there. But what people didn't really clock was that at the time before this, Arnold was saying, no, these weren't extraterrestrial craft. These were, these were American atomic-powered aircraft being test-flown in the area.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is something I'm curious about, and I was hoping maybe you might know. I noticed that you had also written an article on Nikola Tesla's biography for 40 and Times, and a lot of this stuff started, like you said, it was 1947 was that first article, and Nikola Tesla passed away in 1943 after the government had seized, a lot of his papers from his apartment. There was that whole deal where the Czechoslovakian government had tried to get them, and he had written a lot about automatons and using those kind of electrical energies and things like that. Do you think there's a relationship between the government getting a hold of Tesla technology and developing some of those? Do you find any kind of connections there at all?
I couldn't draw direct connections. I think it shows that the fact that the government just did go straight in and grab all Tesla's papers showed they obviously thought there might be something in what he was doing. Tesla was famous for kind of telling tall tales at the same time, talking about death rays and destructo beams and things. So I think they probably just wanted to scour the material for anything that might be useful. But I couldn't say specifically of anything that was directly connected. But that does tie in, so you have Arnold talking about American atomic aircraft, and what people certainly didn't know at the time is that the Americans were experimenting at that point with atomic engines for aircraft. So this would have set alarm bells ringing with the powers that be. So my sense is that Arnold was sent into a very elaborate kind of and complex sort of trap, like a sort of shell game up in Tacoma, which ended up with him just totally confused and tragically with the death of two Air Force intelligence officers who were sent to kind of to follow him and investigate him, and they actually became the U.S. Air Force's very first casualties because the Air Force was only incorporated shortly before. So, you know, even from the very, very beginning of the UFO story, you have the sense of a genuine sort of entanglement with the intelligence services. And I think in this case, it was to try and assess whether Arnold was perhaps passing information to people he shouldn't be, or was even, you know, a mole, or spreading disinformation, or for the Soviets, and we can speculate. But you know, from 1947 on, I think every step of the UFO story, all of the kind of key themes that kind of return endlessly through the story. So, you know, flying craft from outer space, visitors from outer space, UFO crashes, underground bases, alien abductions, a lot of this stuff, if it's not directly seeded by the military or the intelligence services themselves, is certainly at times encouraged and elaborated on and exploited for their own purposes.
Well, one of the wonderful things about your book is again, anybody who's interested in UFOs, and particularly who has an open mind but not a credulous mind, you know, realizes that you just start to enter into the literature and you soon get lost. It's like you're getting absorbed into a parallel world of facts and assertions and documents, and everything is kind of in quotation marks, and there's a kind of a vertigo to the sense of reality that's produced by, which is partly why some people are attracted to it, myself, for example. I'm not looking for an alternate belief system. I'm not looking to find the truth about aliens. I don't expect that I will find it in this book or this movie or this documentary or this radio show or whatever, because it's kind of this strange information world, and yet there's something very appealing about it. And one of the things that's great about Mirage Men is that in addition to providing a tremendous amount of information and really actually embedding a lot of these familiar stories about Roswell, about the Brazilian farmer who has sex with the red-haired Venusian and all that, but you embed them in like contexts that actually make more sense, and you begin to see the hand of the intelligence services or the military in so many of these events. But in addition to sort of presenting the lore and recontextualizing and presenting your argument about the profound role that the information, the services had in shaping UFO lore, you also tell a story about your own experience, and in particular your own experience of kind of entanglement in the dreams and the synchronicities and the weird characters and the personal relationships that you went through as you researched the book and explored it. So how did you change when you were going through, I mean, from the beginning, even though you knew a lot about UFOs, you know, writing a book is a tremendous amount of research, and you encountered all these bizarre characters, and you had a lot of things happen to you, I know. To talk a little bit about how it affected you and your own sense of reality.
I mean, it really did. I should say that I was working on the book and a documentary at the same time with a friend of mine and colleague called John Lundberg, and we really, you know, we went in as a pair because we really felt that it would be too much for one person to deal with, and it could really destabilize one person to throw. We sort of threw ourselves at the mercy of the field and just sort of wanted to see where we'd end up being kind of washed up. And there really were points where we became genuinely concerned that we were getting in out of our depth as we were meeting people who appeared to have had and may well still have strong connections with the intelligence and military services, and who were just sort of leading us on strange, on merry dances, and eventually often actually telling us that we had it all wrong and the UFO stories were real, and that you know, there really were extraterrestrial visitors and people within the government knew it. And you know, some of these people we're talking to are very, very convincing. So there's a wonderful, I think, a great point in the journey. And I think, you know, I think it's one of my favorite parts in the book, where John, who you know, really is a fairly skeptical character, and had been and still is responsible for making some beautiful crop circles in the Wiltshire countryside, he pretty much cracked and just for a couple of days went. That's perhaps unfair, but he definitely went quiet for a couple of days, and one day just came into a bar that myself and our friend Greg Bishop were at, and just said, "Guys, I'm having a problem. I'm starting to believe that we're wrong and they're right, and I don't know what to do about it." And he was, you know, genuinely distressed and concerned. So the stuff, you know, it really does sort of seep into your system. It's like a toxin or a drug, or, you know, some a delirium, and you start to just become uncertain of things you thought you knew about. And that's how I think people, partly I think that's just the weight and the sheer amount of information that's out there. And then when you start encountering credible and convincing people who tell you these stories, you know, you do start to listen to them and to believe them. And I think that's one of the ways in which the UFO lore has become kind of so prevalent within military and even political circles and with some quite powerful people. But actually, with Greg Bishop, who's a great guy and a great researcher based in Los Angeles, he put it, he sort of phrased what had happened to us in occult terms. Actually, he said, "Well, we were sitting one night, and he actually said to us, you know, guys, I've sensed a change in you both since you started this project. You know, when you came in, you were laughing at things, you found everything funny, and, you know, thought you were on top of the game, and now you're different. You know, you've got quieter, you're more serious and considered about what you're doing, and you know, I think you've crossed the abyss and sort of starting to see things from the other side." And I think, you know, that was a really clear point in the adventure. And I'm glad you pick up on the dreams in the book. To me, they were a very important sort of narrative strand, showing kind of different stages of my sort of unconscious reflection on the subject as well, going from very strange dreams I had in the 90s about our Queen Elizabeth II as an extraterrestrial, through to kind of dancing dolphin-like UFOs kind of flying in the air above me at the end of the journey, realizing that, you know, I could never catch them and never pin them down, and I don't think anyone can. So yes, it's been, you know, it has been, I should say I am convinced of my own conclusions by this point after all the research. The conclusions I kind of talk about in the book about the sort of role of disinformation in shaping the UFO myth, I think I'm fairly certain I've got right, I think. So,
yeah, well, I want to talk more about both of those things in a minute, but we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're talking to Mark Pilkington, author of Mirage Men, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society, with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
Yeah. Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern here on PRN.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with our host, Eric Davis, and our guest, Mark Pilkington, talking about UFOs and disinformation. Mark, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that's the most fascinating to me about the UFO story is this kind of recapitulation of our origin. And if you look at, like, the Zechariah Sitchin stuff with the Anunnaki, that they really, the aliens provide a sort of origin for our civilization and ourselves. And there's been some psychologists that even compare it to birth itself. Like, you go through this long tunnel that you're kind of getting abducted. You go out, and it's light, and there's these beings with big eyes, which they say when babies see people's faces, they just focus on the eyes. So that could be, like, a possible archetypal experience. And I was curious, do you think that part of the disinformation is that, do they manipulate that kind of desire for a connection to origin with a lot of these UFO stories? Do you feel like that's something that is kind of, that they're using to draw upon?
I think it's actually something that's always been there in the lore, but certainly in the early 80s, I think that there's little doubt that information was fed into the sort of UFO community that, you know, the aliens had been sending, the visitors or the aliens had been sending emissaries to Earth sort of over the past 2,000 years, and one of them was effectively Jesus, another was Muhammad, and maybe another was Buddha, and that, you know, that kind of material was fed, folded back into the culture. But but, you know, Zechariah Sitchin and Eric von Daniken were talking about this, you know, a decade before that. And it goes right back to the 50s and the 60s as well, where you had great books like God Drives the Flying Saucer and Flying Saucers. And these are real books, Flying Saucers in the Bible. And, you know, people would interpret Ezekiel's wheel as a UFO. And one thing that's really interesting, and I try to show in the book, is that in the sort of early days of the UFO culture as it developed, there was very little difference really between, there was a great deal of overlap between, say, spiritualism and occultism and UFO enthusiasm. And so I was just yesterday having another look at a lovely book from the late 50s called Flying Saucer Pilgrimage by Helen and Bryant Reeve, and they go on a sort of journey around America to meet all the contactees, the people who had met aliens. But actually, in the end, they, well, about halfway through the book, rather, they decide that they're actually better off just talking to the aliens themselves, so they sit down with a reel-to-reel tape recorder and start channeling extraterrestrials using a technique called outer space communication, and, you know, start talking to them. And one of the questions they ask is, was Jesus an alien, and, you know, have you been feeding human life here, and, you know, should we listen to the Bible? So it's all been part of the story from the very beginning. And it was only later, actually, that in the later 40s and through the 50s, that UFOs became a kind of acceptable subject for, you know, for the sensible, rational, scientific-minded man who likes tinkering with radio sets in his garage to take an interest in. So it moved away from, although the Cerveza Terek and religious side is still very strong, it is something that's been there from the start.
Right, it's partly the fact that there is a real claim about reality that gives ufology its particular flavor, where you can look at it from the outside, and obviously it has many religious patterns or patterns you'd identify with mysticism and with encounters, and you can, you know, see them, and sometimes they're quite explicitly in the more spiritual material. But what really gives it that particular flavor is that it gets translated or transformed into this into a modern world of information, of institutions, of bureaucracies, of technology, of media control. So it's an amazing fusion of the two. I mean, I have to say that when I finished the book, I was very convinced. And it's not often that I like finish a book about these kinds of liminal topics and could say something like very convinced. I mean, I'm not convinced that everything that everyone's seen is a product of some kind of military technology or information game. I know that you don't say that either, and that's one of the things that makes it even more convincing, is that you clearly still have an open mind about the possibility of anomalous experience in those stranger dimensions of the human mind. Nonetheless, I remain pretty convinced about the degree and intensity and thoughtfulness of the disinformation campaigns within ufology. But this leads to inevitably the question: how are people reacting to this? What kind of feedback have you gotten? What's happening in the scene?
It's interesting. I mean, the book is sort of been extreme. I really wrote the book with people outside of ufology in mind, because you know, I think one of the things I wanted to do was just show people who wouldn't actually take an interest in the subject just how fascinating it really is. But I also obviously wrote it to people inside, and so far, I have to say, there have been some people who are sort of inside the UFO community who have really taken to it, and a lot of people who are really just not happy and are largely ignoring it, actually, is what people tend to do. But I've had some, you know, you have things that are annoying and are inevitably going to happen, like people writing long sort of rants about why people shouldn't read this book, and then you find out that this person hasn't read it themselves. and that's, you know, that happens with anything. That's a sort of classic situation, people complaining that a film will destroy young minds, and actually you find none of the people complaining about it have ever seen it. But so I think, you know, what I really hope is that it will, that if people who are invested either emotionally ontologically in the UFO story, it will just provide them a fresh frame within which, through which they can view, you know, view the story and view people's experiences. The book's actually sort of formally released in the US in a couple of weeks, so I think then we'll start hearing more about it. But it's been very interesting. There's another UFO book that's sort of out at the moment that's very much a pro UFO, not necessarily sort of pro-UFO book that's out at the moment, and all of the kind of UFO community are rooting for that one, because it's kind of it's a more comfortable story, which is the story that's been told many times before.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, your conclusion that you come to? I mean, obviously you don't have to give away the ending or anything, but just about, like, how the disinformation informs it, like, just in a sort of paragraph.
Sure. I mean, I think basically what I'm saying is the analogy I would use is something like a punctuated equilibrium in evolutionary biology. So you have, you know, the law is sort of self-perpetuating and self-generating, but at times when it suits them, when it's expedient to do so, intelligence agencies or the Air Force, or sometimes quite likely the Navy as well, will feed new material into the UFO community, which acts as either a distraction or creates a sort of cover story for one of their own operations. But the effect that these seeds and this kind of fertilizer has in the bed of the UFO lore is that it creates its own strange new sort of permutations and evolutions to take place, and you'll get, you know, odd new stories percolating in different parts of the community. But I think there's definitely traces. You can sort of follow the story back, like a barium meal kind of going through somebody's body in a hospital. You can actually show where the seeds are planted and see which elements and which strands of the UFO lore kind of have evolved from these particular placements. And this has been going on, as I say, from the beginning. And as recently, the last person we spoke to who admitted to have been doing this work was working in the late 1990s. So I think it's, you know, I'm absolutely sure it's still going on. And I don't think all of it's as spectacular as some of the cases I describe in the book, like the most spectacular being the Paul Benowitz affair from the early 1980s, where they got as far as allegedly creating signs of an underground alien base on a mesa in remote New Mexico and sort of flying him over it to show him where the aliens lived. And this is real, and that story is now an absolutely kind of critical foundation stone of the contemporary UFO lore. And in fact, they had the first underground alien base conference at the small town Dulce, just last year, and the hotel was not able to cater for all of the delegates who showed up. There were so many people that they had to have people sort of out in other rooms being fed, given video feeds of the proceedings. So it's powerful stuff.
It's very powerful, and it reflects so much. I mean, that's the amazing thing. Why it seems to me that it's incredibly important to look at the UFO material, because it just tells you so much, like a dream, like the way in psychoanalytic terms you can read a dream and you can find the shadows and the unresolved contradictions in the person. By looking at the UFOs, you can see these deep shadows and cracks in our modern world. It's about information. It's about authority. It's about the divide between the military and the public. It's about media. I mean, it's really extraordinary. A loop, you know, these sort of nested feedback loops you get into. One of which that I really like the way you pointed out the irony of the psychological framework of a lot of UFO believers is this sense that on the one hand they believe that the government is lying. So they're convinced that the government is lying about the UFOs, and yet what they want more than anything else is for the government to say, yes, actually we knew about this all the time, and we had been lying to you. So that in itself, like that little loop, captures the sort of dynamics of so much of this field. And it's almost in the end like about how information works, or how media and documentation and authority construct reality. It really is a kind of performance art in a way, except it's being done for very specific reasons, at least some of the time.
Yeah, I don't think there's very much difference between a kind of artistic hoax or a performance and a psychological warfare operation, except, you know, the motivations for the two are slightly, you know, can can be different. But yes, well, I mean,
and you
I
can think well, you can the, speak about this because you participated in crop circle creation, and that's kind of the supreme example of an artistic creative hoax in the sense that the circle maker doesn't want to be revealed, and there's now a whole culture of people who believe that the circles are messages from beyond or something of that sort. So there really is I'd never thought about the relationship between the circle builders and the kind of mirage men who manufacture these UFO scenarios.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of grudging respect on both sides. So, and that's one of the reasons John and I were so fascinated with the story, because we saw really close parallels between what the circle makers had been doing and what the mirage men were doing. And you know, one of our really great moments was sitting at a week-long UFO conference, of a boot camp for UFO believers, and watching videos of crop circles being formed by mysterious flying lights that I knew John had actually concocted, he'd got someone to concoct using video editing equipment that's always shown in UFO and the crop circle videos, and sitting watching our kind of key contact, Richard Doty, you know, completely mesmerized by this footage, and afterwards saying, sort of whispering, you know, John made that, and this look of total awe and wonder on his face afterwards, like, how did you do that? That's amazing. So, I think it's, you know, as I say in the book, watching people seeing that footage with sort of wonder on their faces must be a similar experience to the Mirage Men sort of picking up a copy of UFO magazine or going sort of online to any of the many UFO sites and seeing their handiwork kind of proudly on display. It must be a strange but kind of in some ways pleasing feeling, I think.
What kind of impact do you think that this disinformation has on, because I always think about this, and you can see it in so many different areas of life. I mean, whether it's celebrity culture or, you know, religion, like all the different stories that come out about the Bible or Jesus and how there's so many different, you know, sources that all say kind of different things, and then you kind of like totally lose track of what the first source is. Like, you could even look at the Catholic Church and how they'll kind of propagate different stories, alternative stories about Jesus to get away from old pagan stories or whatever. I think that's kind of like a good metaphor. You could even look at how they change the pagan stories into something else. What kind of impact do you think that this disinformation upon these kind of UFO mythologies have on our culture as a whole, like how we even would process this information? Do you think it's beneficial for us, or do you think it's just really detrimental?
I don't think you can sort of say it's either beneficial or detrimental. Certainly, it serves a purpose, and actually, I sort of suggest in the book that one of the sort of reasons perhaps behind in the 50s some of this sort of activity was the real fear that after the horrors of World War II, there was a sense that people were going to lose their religion, lose their faith in God, and you know, it was technology really that won the war. So that, you know, you could perhaps see that the sense that perhaps if they could create a kind of religious technology which out of the UFO, perhaps this could be something that people could look to for the need for the salvation that every religion kind of has to promise its adherents. So I think it definitely does a good job of mopping up a lot of people who might otherwise lose their sense of wonder and awe at the world, which is something that we all find in different ways, either through science or through religion or watching movies or whatever. I think everyone needs that feeling, and I think the UFO story and the UFO lore really does provide it.
One of the things also is that by opening up this world of disinformation and getting a sense of some of the characters, some of the leading characters involved in it,
you realize that even on from their side of the story, things are not so clear either. I mean, when you sort of, if you lay out your basic thesis, then the image, of course, is a bunch of, you know, guys with buzz haircuts and, you know, suits sitting around a table saying, okay, well, what we're going to do, we're going to plant this information here, and then they're going to da-da-da-da. But, of course, what the reality is that the infectious power of the UFO lore is also infecting the services themselves. And you ask, in a way, the great enigmas of your book are not, are UFOs real or are they extraterrestrials? The great enigmas are, what's motivating some of these people? Because what they're doing at a certain point is no longer exactly logical from a perspective of, from the military's perspective. It almost seems like they too have been infected in some sense.
I think they have. I mean, I genuinely think a lot of people in some powerful positions or positions of responsibility have been, if we want to use that sort of word, infected by the meme. And certainly, I don't think there's any question of that whatsoever. You look at someone like John Podesta, who's a sort of was Bill the Clinton administration's White House chief of staff and helped manage the transition from the Bush administration to the current administration. So he's a real Washington insider, and he's outspoken in his fascination for the subject and his belief that there is, there are things buried within the government's files and records that have not been seen yet, and may point to the reality of, you know, extraterrestrial or at least ufological technology. And he's actually even recently written the foreword to a new UFO book. So, and people within the military certainly, and in other countries, the Brazilians just released the Brazilian Defense of Department released a lot of its UFO files, and in that you see that in the 80s, a very senior, one of the most senior Air Force officials was an absolute dyed-in-the-wool UFO believer, and actually on his own, you know, off his own back, organized investigations of UFO sightings to find evidence of ET technology. So, and the same has happened, I'm sure, all around the world. So yeah, it's just a very infectious meme, and it's a very reasonable one to believe. I mean, to believe that we've been visited by technologically advanced beings from out there is certainly far less irrational than, you know, a lot of things that a lot more people believe in. So.
Well, one thing we haven't really been talking about is this sort of, if you will, Jacques Vallée line about showing the links between the phenomena and the people's experiences, or the stories that we have about people's experiences, and the sort of all these traditions in history and mythology about folkloric beings and fairy lore and spirits and incubi and succubi, as if that there's kind of an aspect of the human consciousness, a collective aspect of the human consciousness that keeps reappearing in our world wearing different guises, and that in the old days it was elves and now it's aliens, and you can see the same kind of tricky, trickster-like characteristics, etc. I know you're warm to that approach to some degree. How do you see that jibing with this story about disinformation and about control and about manipulating the UFO field? How do those two worlds sort of overlap in your head now?
Yeah, and I think the way that they overlap is the word you used just then with the trickster. And I know I listened to your interview with the brilliant George Hansen a few months ago, but I think he's really nailed it. And I think you know, all of these things, what the role that they play is in some way the kind of unconscious necessity that we as complex beings and as a complex society and increasingly complex sort of network society have a need to sort of inject instability and uncertainty into our world, I think. And I think that's what all of these stories that have been told for hundreds of years are really about all beings that kind of manifest that sort of instability and that destabilizing influence. So if you look at the fairy lore of the sort of of hundreds of years ago, that these characters, you know, they play tricks. That's what they do. They confuse people. They bamboozle them. You know, it's just, the term pixie led was used to describe people who had lost their bearings and were sort of wandering around sort of in a dazed and confused fashion through the countryside. So I think that's, and the disinformation is just sort of another kind of active militarized sort of layer of tricksterization. I think if you could weaponize the trickster, then you'd have the UFO, I think.
That's a good way of putting it, because it's that they're carrying forward a tradition too, whether they're conscious of it or not, that the both the people who are starting the stories and the people who carry them forward, and yet there's this real distinct difference as well. It's kind of what I referred to at the beginning, what makes the UFO so fascinating, is that you can't resolve it into one particular framework. I mean, you have to, it's so multi-dimensional. It's psychology and folklore and technology and information and media, and there's no way to say, oh, this level is the level of reality. Even when you take a largely skeptical view like yours, you still finish your book with a sense of wonder and puzzlement and amazement. Mm-hmm. And it's not like everything is tied up neatly in a box. I want to point out to listeners that Mark is the editor of Strange Attractor journal, and you can find out more about him and the journal and his other doings at strangeattractor.co.uk /further. Is there another site people can find out more about Mirage Men, Mark?
Yeah, I've set up a Mirage Men site which I've been updating pretty regularly with material kind of connected to or related to the book, and that's miragemen.wordpress.com, and there's actually a lot of material on there, and I'm also kind of feeding responses I get from people and interviews and things back into that, and I'll also be using it to publish a few of the sections of the book that I ended up dropping for various reasons. So
nice.
it should be an ongoing active entity in its own right, I hope.
And I assume that if we follow it, then we can be present for the final revelation, where you do admit that you are indeed an agent of
the
British
intelligence. I'm a reptilian leprechaun.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for being with us on Expanding Mind, and thanks, Maja.
Thanks, Maja.